Season 2 of Ricardo's Rules of Resilience podcast is brought to you by RamFit. Here at RamFit, we take material destined for landfill and turn it into high-performance training gear that lasts because we believe we can have fitter people and a fitter planet. In the dynamic world of fitness equipment, our indestructible training tools made from recycled materials promises to revolutionize your workouts and deliver unmatched durability. By embracing the RamFit philosophy, you're not only enhancing your workouts, but also contributing to a more sustainable future. RamFit. Fitter people, fitter planet.
Welcome, everyone, to the Ricardo's Rules of Resilience podcast, the podcast where we give you the tools to withstand and recover from difficulties. I'm your co-host, Coach Alton, along with Coach Ricardo. And today, you guys, we got another super special guest on. We got the Ram co-creator, JP Mohn, on today. Thank you for coming on today, JP.
Hey, guys. Yeah, thanks very much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
It's definitely a pleasure to have you on today, and super excited to dive into it more. But to get it started off, for the viewers that may not know you, tell us a little bit about yourself, a quick elevator pitch about who you are, what you're about.
I'm JP. I'm from Ireland. I'm based here in Ireland most of the time. I own a company along with another guy. Dermot is my business partner in RamFit. So basically we manufacture fitness equipment, functional fitness equipment, from recycled materials. You may or may not know of one of our main products being the Ram Roller, which is used in the likes of racing such as Decafit. You know, a lot of people are using it for their training, that type of thing. We'll probably get into a little bit more on that. But yeah, I'm married. I've got four kids. You know, I'm very ordinary, just like a lot of people in this world. But yeah, like I said, I have a business that takes me to further fields outside of Ireland. You know, both into Europe, UK, you know, America, where I met you guys, obviously. So I get to meet a lot of people, and I probably like to think I'm very much a people's person. I like meeting people. You know, I like chatting to people from different backgrounds. I love listening to their stories and what they're about. I like telling them where I'm from. So yeah, I'm very much a people's person. So yeah, and I've been lucky that way. The job that I have allows me to do that. You know, and I think I'm best when I'm doing that.
And we got the opportunity to meet you out in LA in the Impact Idea World back in 2023, and it was awesome to connect with you then, get to meet you, and go out to eat with you and stuff like that. And one of the things when we met you that we learned about was Gaelic football, and one of the big things, it's a lot based on the local community. There's not a lot of transitioning to different teams. So if you could tell us a little bit more about the ethos that comes with that, because it's a pretty unique thing for you guys.
I'm glad you called it football, because for us it's proper football. You
get that's right.
I know you guys have your American football, which is great, and since you know, I always knew American football, and since going to America, I've really got to enjoy it. Once I got to understand the rules, I'm still trying to understand the rules, but once you understand the rules more, it makes it a lot more enjoyable. But and then obviously the Brits, they have their soccer, and the rest of the world have their soccer, but we've got proper football over here. But no, sorry, I jest. But yeah, it's basically it's my sport. It's where we came from. It's actually in theory and in reality, it's actually where RamFit, our company, grew out of. The idea originates relating back to our own training, our own sport, which is called Gaelic football. We have a couple of sports, actually. There's Gaelic football and hurling, and they're Gaelic games. Absolutely huge in Ireland. You know, there's a couple of unique things other than it's mainly based in Ireland. Yes, it's played in other parts of the world, but it's played by Irish people who have gone to four corners of the earth. teams right across America, but they're all local teams. Irish people live over there. We brought the sport over there and play it just as passionately as we do back here. But the ethos of it is it's all amateur. So if you guys were to YouTube it quickly to see what's this thing he's talking about, you'd probably see thousands of people in the stadiums, these players on the pitch, moving the ball really fast, and you think, wow, these guys are like, you know, American footballers or soccer players in the Premiership in the UK. But no, all the players are actually all amateur, all ordinary guys. They play in front of 40, 50, 60,000, 80,000 people at the top level, and they go to work on a Monday morning after playing on a Sunday. It's very amateur status, and we're quite proud of that, actually, because that's the foundation of what the actual sport is built on. A lot of money is created through it, but it all flows back into the local communities and into the local clubs, as we call them. So basically, the idea or how it is actually structured, it's built around where you're from. You know, there's a lot of pride in your area, where you're from. And if you can imagine, I'm from a certain club. I'm a country boy, I'm a country bumpkin. I don't mind admitting it. I live out in the country and we've quite a small area. But within my county, we call them counties in Ireland. There are 32 counties on the island of Ireland. So the county would be like the equivalent of a state. In obviously not the same size scale as in the US. Within that county, you have an area, and that's where your club. At the end of the day, in our sport, I have a good friend who's very passionate about it, and he always says, the club is where you start, and the club is where you finish. And you go in to the club when you're like 3, 4, 5 years old, and you learn the skills of the game from an early age, you go right up through the ranks. So right up through juveniles, as we call it, which is, you know, the underage age groups, and then up to under 18, or even after that, you can progress on into adult football. And again, you still play with your club. You don't transfer. You don't want to transfer. You don't want anybody transferring into you. It's very tribal. If you want to think of it the way it's actually very tribal. You go to play your adult football. If you're good enough, there's the opportunity to go on to play at a higher level. Myself and Dermot, my business partner with Ramfit, we were lucky to get that opportunity. So again, when it comes to the county level things, it's a cluster of these clubs that are within this county that make up the county team. So it's like playing, like I said, for your state, being picked to play for your state versus every other state in the country or every other county in the country. And that's played at quite a higher level. So again, if you YouTubed it and you've seen these thousands of people attending these games on TV, you know, that's where you're playing at the elite level. And again, very much pride of place. That is the county that you're from. The guys that you battle with, another part of the season, the club competitions, you literally battle against them. They come together and are just as proud and as passionate about playing for their jersey to represent their people. So in a sense, you're representing your people. There's very much that mentality to it. I was lucky. I got to represent my county for 12, 13, 14 seasons. Played, you know, from a club, you know, an adult level for 16, 17, 18 seasons. And unfortunately, I had to retire a little bit early with a bit of a wonky knee, but that was into my 30s, well into my 30s. So I was, pretty successful in that sense. But again, a lot of people go through their career and might not win anything. But it's not about that. Those people are just as passionate about it. So like I said, it starts with your club, finishes with your club. Cut me, I bleed my club, I bleed my county. It's that kind of mentality. And if you ever come to Ireland, every small village, every small town has their own club. And you'll see the you guys call it a football field, we call it a football pitch. You see it there, and it's a big part of every community. Part of the social end of things, the sporting end of things. It's a very safe place to bring your kids. So there's a really strong ethos of, you know, being able to work for things to, you know, it's a great place to take young people where you can teach them, you know, the value of putting in the effort, putting in the work. Sometimes it happens for you, sometimes it doesn't. And if it doesn't, you know, you just go back at it again. If it does, doesn't matter, you still go back at it again, you know. So yeah, that's the sport I'm from.
That's so great. And definitely, if the viewers haven't seen that, the Gaelic football, definitely go check out a YouTube video. It's definitely super entertaining stuff to watch. And it's very super unique how people stay with their club. You used to kind of see that in American sports, like with basketball. You'd have Michael Jordan playing with the Bulls, and he would stay on his team. You'd have Charles Barkley, and all the guys would kind of stay in your team. And unfortunately, you kind of see people starting to team up, switch sides. You don't really have that true pride on the team that you're with, that you started with. And how do you think, with the popularity of it, they've been able to hold the spirit of amateurism at the same time and the local pride within your club? Because like you said, some people might go their entire career without winning anything.
Yeah, it's a great question, Alton. It's what, when you think about it, it's I can't really give you an answer other than it's something deeply ingrained within you. It's like a passion that you have. I often laugh. Like I work with people during the week, you know, from month to month, and we work hard for each other. And you meet people out and about, and everybody's great. But when it comes to game time, we literally kill each other. Not in the obviously this sense we kill you, but you know, and things happen and arguments happen, and then you know it's forgot about. You know, it's all left on the field. But when it comes to the amateurism, I suppose there is a sense of pride in it as well, that the organisation is called the GAA, the Gaelic Athletic Association. And they have always been very strong on maintaining the amateur status. When you talk about, you know, American sport, and I'm sure when anybody goes in, when they first play for their school or their college, you know, it's still very much in that kind of realm where you're willing to put your body on the line. It's probably when money comes on the scene, it leaves it very difficult. And that's why I'm saying the GAA have generally, you know, they've managed, there is a lot of money that's generated around the sport, a lot of money. They've have a system where that money that's generated is filtered all back down through the system into the various county teams, and then down into the actual clubs themselves. So we all get a little bit of the piece of the action for the money that's generated around it. And it's not about that. It's not about the money. If anything, it costs money. You know, it costs money. You know, put a lot of my own time and effort into, now that I'm retired, into coaching the kids and into my own club. You know, I've often travelled back from America and organised my flights beforehand back home for a game or for training. Maybe I came back a little bit early, but that's how stupid and how crazy it is. It's just something that's ingrained in us, and very hard to take that out. It's passed down from generation to generation. You know, I have a brother who lives in Chicago for 25 years. I have another brother who's in London for 20 years, and they always want to know what is happening. What is happening around the They're even though they're very, very far away, they nearly know more what's going on than I do. It's like I said, it's ingrained in your heart and in your body.
You know, and we have people who listen to the podcast and people who watch. And for our listeners who are not watching this on YouTube, I'm watching you, JP, light up as you talk about it and you talk about your club. Your face changes. You know, they have the expression, your eyes light up. And I'm seeing that, you know, you're talking about that pride. And when you say it's deep within you, it's physically present as you talk about it. This truly is a piece of who you are. And, you know, you said it led to your company. I mean, that's how much of a part of you it is. It led to your company of RamFit. Can you talk about how you went from killing each other on the pitch to developing this versatile fitness tool that's now used around the world?
Well, Dermot is my business partner. Dermot is actually my brother-in-law as well. Dermot actually from a rival club, and we would have spent a lot of years kicking each other's asses. But in saying that, Dermot was a very good footballer himself, very good footballer. And he would have played for 18-19 seasons with the county team, and that's where me and him built a relationship within there. And when I say a relationship, it's not that we were buddy relationship. He actually played on the same defensive line as me for quite a long time of our careers, and I suppose when you play alongside somebody like that, you in a team, regardless if it's on the same line, you build up a trust, you know, and when you're playing in a team, in a unit like say Gaelic football, you really do have to trust the men that's with you, you know, especially it's easily done because everybody, when you're playing at that higher level, everybody is putting in the effort, you know, you can see people. It's not for anybody that wants to bluff it, because they're just weeded out straight away. So when you have people, you surround yourself with people who are putting in the effort, and you can see that, you know, you admire that from them, and they push you on then, because you don't want to let them down and they don't want to let you down. So Dermot and me, we had a relationship from then. Obviously, I met his sister, you know, and that, you know, we had another relationship on top of that. But when we came back out of retiring, we had a business. We started a business together, where we were supplying equipment and accessories back into our own sport. And one of the pieces of equipment that we used to train with a lot is sandbags, power bags, great piece of equipment. We used to train with them a lot for speed work, for strength work. You know, a lot of our training is outdoors. You know, obviously you do your gym work, but a lot of the actual, you know, there's a lot of cardio and strength work done outside as well. And we used to use sandbags, power bags a lot. But Ireland being Ireland, it can get quite wet and rain, and you have the traditional problem with sandbags and power bags where they split, they lose their stitching, they leak. You might have a bag that says 20 kg on it, and it could actually only be 12 kg, or if it rains a lot, it might be 25 kg. So, yeah, we started to supply sandbags within our own company, and you know, we were always getting phone calls back saying, guys, you know, we need to replace the stuff that you sold us already. They're bursting, blah blah blah. So we at the time, because of the type that we are, we said, right, let's make our own sandbags, and let's, when we're doing it, let's make the best sandbag ever, thinking that that's what we could do. And tried that, discovered that we couldn't do that. We had the same problems as everybody else, every other sandbag manufacturer. So we scrapped that idea, and we said, right, let's come at this from a different angle. Let's try and solve the problem, though. What is the problem? You know, burst sandbags. It's a simple thing. Let's try and solve that problem. And fast forward to actually the Ram that you see now. We discovered, or in that time, that design that you see now, the original Rams, the prototypes that we had, would have had straps and handles on them. It was when we started to strip it back to the design that you actually see now, that we went, wow, we started giving out to other athletes, other coaches, started training with ourselves, and when we had that design that you see now, we actually discovered, wow, you know, and it used to be a tagline of ours, with less you could do more. And that's how that came about. And that tagline, we used to use that tagline when we first set up the company a lot, because the county that we're actually from, here in Ireland, yes, we've done reasonably well over the years. Very small resources. We're not. I talked about me being a country bumpkin. I'm which I am, and I'm proud to be a country boy. Dermot's actually from a town. I call him a townie. I'm a country boy. But the county itself hasn't very big towns in it. You know, we have our towns, but we'd still be considered a rural county within the island of Ireland. We have quite a small population, so. Like the max population of our county is something like, which is like a large town for you guys over there, it's something only like 66,000-67,000. Whereas you compare that to somebody, to like a county like Dublin, so they have like up in 1.5 million people. Again, the way the system is, it doesn't matter if you're born into Dublin, that's part of your DNA. If I don't want to play for Dublin, this is my thing. So we would have competed against Dublin and done quite well against them and the other bigger counties around. So what we would have had to learn, and that's why I'm going back to that line, with less can do more. You know, so that was something that me and Dermot carried into the company itself. You know, that maybe we don't have the resources, you know, that the big companies have. You know, it's just me and him, and you know, we learned to, I suppose going back even to our footballing days, you know, we learned to be, to have that drive that we had. We trusted each other and to make this happen.
So powerful what you're saying about the simpler can be better sometimes. Sometimes we get so wrapped up in adding in all these features and everything that we can. And I feel like that's why the RAM is so perfect, because it's simple. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way, because it's simply perfect in a way and in the design. And as you were coming up with the design, you evolved from a sandbag. So was it like a thought in the shower that you got the idea for what we have now, or was it just through the development process that we got to where we're at, or how did we get to this beautiful tool?
We knew we wanted to create something, and funny story is that I was with Dermot one day, and we used to rent a unit I used to work from, and Dermot was in the building up above, and we're standing out in the car parking lot, just chatting about different things, whatever we're chatting about. And a courier, this was back in the early, very early stages, a courier pulled up delivering something for Dermot. And the doors opened up, it was a package, whatever it was, Dermot was signing for it. And he happened to just look in the back of the van. There was these two long tubular kind of things. And we had a design in our head, and we were trying to figure out how do we make this. And Dermot just happened to ask the question, what's them two things? And your guy said, I don't know, I'm not too sure. And then we were looking at it, it was a bollard, two bollards, believe it or not. I don't know if you guys use that term over there, but it's like two stands, two round stands that people would maybe, you know, put into the ground to around something. And Dermot was like, where did they come from, or where did you get them? And he goes, well, I don't know. And where are they being delivered to? And he says, I can't tell you that. You know, it's confidential, obviously. But Dermot managed to get out of him where it was being delivered to. So he went and he talked to that company, like, where did you get these made, or where did these come from? So they're actually these bollards, a company about 40 miles away, were actually making them. They made like mats. You know, they make like rubber mats for house sheds. Factory floors, but they were making these bollards that used to go inside cash machines to protect people from driving into them, smashing into them.
Pylons.
Pylons. We call them bollards. So when we seen that, we went, wow, that's very similar to the shape that we were looking. So we went up, we actually got it out of the company that they were being delivered to, where they bought them from. We went up and we met them, and these guys were making it out of recycled tires, rubber. So we were like, yeah, that's pretty smart. And we started talking to them about what we wanted to do. So that's where the original idea, to answer your question, that's where it came. We knew we had this design, but we didn't know really how to actually make it. Now again, when we actually took just the pylons, and we, like I said, we had our design, but now the next problem for us was actually getting it made. These, like, the guys, the pylons that the guys had were like, they were like 9-10 inches in diameter. Like ours was, we wanted ours 6 inches. We still needed a different way of doing it from the way those guys were doing it. That was the next problem that we had. We had the design, we had an idea what to make it from. Again, when it comes to RAM, actually stands for recycle and move. But we have an ethos to the company. It's not that we're green eco warriors that's gonna, you know, we can't be this and we can't be that. We're not like that. But it comes, we do have a certain ethos to the company, and I suppose that comes from us both being family men. You know, we have our kids, and we we do, you know, it comes back to just being, doing something that's right for everybody else. You know, we come into this world, I'd like to think that when we go to leave this world, that we leave it in maybe a little bit better place than when we first came into it. And I suppose maybe this ethos to the company, that's our way of maybe trying to achieve that.
We'll get back to more JP right after this break.
This episode is brought to you by Elevate Training Grounds, inviting you to their five-lane DECA event October 19th with DECA Strong, DECA Mile, Ruck, Teams, and Kids Division. This five-lane event is going to be full of energy and a whole bunch of fun. You don't want to miss it. There's a costume contest with a prize for whoever completes their DECA event in the best costume. Not only that, there's going to be a big prize for the Iron Man Award. The person who completes DECA Strong Ruck, DECA Mile Ruck, DECA Strong Teams, and DECA Mile Teams with the best combined time for those four events. Don't miss out on this event. Tons of energy. Elevate always puts on a good time, and with five lanes, you're not going to want to miss it. See you October 19th in South Bend. Welcome back from the break. We are here with JP Mohn, the co-founder, co-inventor of the RAM fitness tool. He's coming to us here from Ireland. JP, you've been telling us all about how the RAM came into being, its origin story. And, you know, anytime you're going to be an entrepreneur, you got to have resilience. And that is our podcast. What we're trying to do is help people understand what it takes to withstand and recover from difficulties. So you've got this idea. You've got this beautiful ethos of we want to do what we can do to help the planet and look forward to our helping our kids not have such full landfills and going to reuse these recycled tires. You've got this great idea. And now the fun begins, right? Now is when you got to be resilient because you're going to be an entrepreneur. Can you talk about some of the setbacks that you encountered and exactly how you overcame those?
I suppose I did allude to, as you asked, how did the idea came about? And, you know, that's basically the story of how it actually came about. And we knew we had something, the next thing was trying to get it made. So I always remember we had the other company, and we hadn't actually set up RAMFIT. It was way in the distance at this stage, but we wanted to get this product made to the specification that we had in this design. I remember us trying to go, we actually got a mold made at one stage, and it cost us $1,000 at the time. It was $1,000 that we didn't have, you know, and we're debating should we spend it in this and whatever. But anyway, we spent the money and we got this really ragtag mold made of our original RAM. I remember, and if you compare it to, it's still in my office, you know, I've always kept it. And if you compared it to what their actual RAM is now, it's a very rough outline of what it is. But it was roughly what we wanted. And then said, yeah, I think we've got something here. We'd done a little bit of training with it. We said, yeah, I think we've got something here. Then the next thing was, how are we going to make this? And I remember us going to various engineer companies, actually asking them, you know, this is the product that we have, you know, can you make this for us? I remember getting various quotes back of 100,000. I think there was one for 150,000. Yeah, actually the one that gave us a quote of 150,000 to make the machine, to make this product that we had basically in our heads, they said, yeah, it's 150,000. And even then it's going to be trial and error. We mightn't get it right. And I was like, man, 100,000, 150,000, you know, how are we going to do this? So about 6 months passed, and I was in the unit that we used to rent at the time, and a good friend of mine, sort of like a mentor, came in one day to have a quick chat. He was passing by, came in for a chat. He seen the RAM, the prototype RAM, sitting in the corner. He was giving a little bit of a kick, and he says, what about this thing? Did you ever do much with this thing? There's something in that, you know? And I goes, yeah, I know there's something in it. I think that, but And then I told him the story about 100,000, 150,000, what it's going to cost to make a machine. And he just went, you should talk to my friend Eamon. You know, he might be able to help you. He's on a bit of a loose end at the minute. And, you know, he's made machines for different engineering companies. You should chat to him. So, lo and behold, Eamon, in a former life, I worked with this guy, Eamon's brother, for quite a number of years. And I actually sort of knew Eamon, but we were introduced. Eamon came in, explained to him what we were looking. And Eamon is your typical kind of Irish man, you know, just, you know, tradesman looking at it going, yeah, I can understand. I know what you mean. Actually, my son, I'm after buying a sugar pint roller for my son just last week. He was an athlete. He knew what a roller was. That was a good thing. And he said, leave it for me and I'll come back to you. He came back to me within a week and he kind of had a little bit of a sketch done out on machine. And me and Dermot were looking at each other going, it was literally on the, now he didn't smoke, but it was literally on the back of a cigarette box kind of thing. And we were like, well, right, okay, I mean, what do you need for this? And he said, well, I need to buy some parts. So we went, yeah, well, we gave him 2,000, I think it was 2,000 euro at the time. It's about $2,500. And he said, good stuff, I'll come back to you. So about a month passed, and me and Dermot were in the office one day, and he just happened to ask, were you chatting with Eamon since? I went, no, and we went, Jesus, what happened to him? Was he taking our money and run? He happened to just ring us that day, and he said, listen, I've something done here. Why not come out to my place and take a look and see what you think? So out we went. He wasn't too far. He was only about 20 minutes drive away from where we were based. And he had a lovely old country house, and he had these sheds out the back. It was a really lovely setting where he was based, and took us into the sheds and pulled back this canopy, and there was this machine sitting there in front of us, and we were looking at it going, what's this? And what he did, he said, just stand back, I'm going to show you something. And what he did, he got a bunch of wet sawdust. He got a bucket of sawdust, put water in to make it all wet, fed it into the machine, went in one end, came out the other end, and as it came out in the shape, me and Darren looked at each other and went, is it that's the shape we wanted, that's exactly it. And even though it was only wet sawdust, we went, oh, that's the Eamon, that's what we wanted. And he goes, okay, can you get me some of the raw material? We went, yeah, we'll get you some raw material. So anyway, we gave him another $3,000. He tightened the machine up. He needed to do lots of different things to it. But that was the very first machine. Eamon built that machine for us. And we still actually use that machine. That makes the baby rams. It still makes the baby. So we still have that machine. And every machine that we have built that is actually is designed on that original machine that he made, where, you know, we've obviously modified it. And, you know, health and safety probably wouldn't have been at the forefront of the original machine, to be honest. But we've built all the other machines based on the same ethos of what the first machine did. Like I said to you, I mentioned that he was at a loose end. Eamon, why he was at a loose end at the time, he was a really talented man. Didn't go to college, hadn't any big engineering qualifications, but was just one of these guys that throw his hand at anything. But Eamon had cancer at the time. And it ended up for the next year and a half, 2 years, we worked with Eamon. You know, we were always modifying. We hadn't got it fully right. I remember there was issues over the mix. You know, the machine was perfect, but it was the mix, you know, getting flaws out. But Eamon had cancer at the time. And Dermot spent a lot of time with him over those 2 years, 2.5 years, you know, out in that back shed of his, and developing the product. And fortunately, we lost Eamon then, back in 2018. And I always remembered Eamon, it was the day after Christmas Day. We call it Boxing Day over here, St. Stephen's Day. And me and Dermot had gone to his house just on Christmas. It was actually just the day before Christmas Eve to say our goodbyes. Eamon was in the bed And you know, it was, I remember Dermot was quite emotional at the time when we came out, and he was quite emotional too. And you know, because we'd spent a lot of time with this man, you know, he helped us a lot to develop what we want. Obviously we were with him, and you know, but you build up a relationship. And he'd a young son. He was 16 at the time. He'd his wife. You know, a great family around him that evening, and we went into the room on our own with him. You know, and we shook his hand. You know, we said our goodbyes, and we went out the door. I also remember Dermot saying to me, we were driving off, you know, there's about that house. He says, did you notice anything about that house? It's just so calm. You know, that the new death was coming to that house, and but it was just so calm at the time. But Eamon, I remember, like I said, Christmas Day passed, and then I had friends who were home. We actually went to the local pub, and we were having a drink, and a buzz came through on my phone, and I looked down at the text, and it was just a text from Eamon's brother, who I used to work with, saying, JP, just to let you know, Eamon's just gone. It was a little bit hard at the time. You know, it was a little bit, I was having to go a number of weeks later, and we had to take the machine away from the shed. We were moving to a new place at the time, and all the stuff, all these wee tables that Eamon, worktops that Eamon had made to help the whole process of what we were doing. But yeah, Eamon was, I often think of him, especially every Christmas, obviously, every Christmas. But yeah, that's something that was part of our process. When you talk about how we managed to make the ram and come about, it's much part of our story.
Such a powerful story, and it's so sad, but at the same time it's pretty incredible that he was able to get something done like that right before he passed away. But it's a great story and a cool part about the Rams story with that. And then I wanted to transition, so you've spent all this time with the development and figuring out how you're going to actually produce this fitness equipment, and we heard this story from Yancey's perspective, so I thought it'd be interesting to hear it from your perspective as well. So you have this product, and now you got to figure out how you're going to distribute it and make it popular. So tell us a little bit about how you got RAM implemented with Spartan Races, and then eventually now they're in Deca Races.
JP, now we all, having heard the story, have reasons and reminders to remember Eamon, as we all, you know, those of us who have that pound RAM are able to look back and say, hey, this was made on the machine created by your friend. So we now all have a memory that we can keep his memory alive with.
What I'll do is after or tomorrow when I'm back in the factory, very first ram that came out of the machine that Eamon did with that particular machine, Eamon had a habit of putting, especially in those first 20, 30 prototypes that he did, but in the very first one he put a little bit of tape on it with number one on it, and that stayed in his shed the whole time. I took it with me. It's actually in my office. I call it number one. And it's just sitting in my office, and you know, every time I look at it, you know, Eamon obviously pops into my head. But I'll send you a picture of it, just for you to see it. Moved to a slightly bigger facility at the time, and we were still very much our development stage. We probably only had, again, when I look back, the amount of odd rams that we made. we couldn't, and it was all in the machine was perfect, but we figured out it was in our mix, but it took us so long to try and figure out how to mix properly, because there is quite simple ingredients in it, but it's how you mix it and how the timing and all that. So there's a load of different you know, things that was messing up the, you know, that we couldn't just get it right. But anyway, we had the product, and we started taking it to different coaches and athletes, like I said, and I started putting it out around Ireland. You know, just getting in the car, just going to a few gyms, that type of thing. And Ireland's a great, you know, we're a great wee country. You know, we're a great country, and we have a lot of good people in the world of fitness and in every industry, like any other country. But when it comes to certain things, we're always a little bit behind. So in the world of fitness, you know, I always say America is where generally 90%, 95% of fitness originates in your ideas around it, originates in the US, and the way it works is the US, Europe, Ireland, you know, that kind of process. We're 3-4 years behind, you know, so whether it's TRX, Zumba, whatever, you know, we're always that little bit behind. So when I took this thing around this number of gyms for about 6, 8, 9 months, 12 months, I got enough response, a lot of like sort of kickbacks or a lot of put downs or a lot of like, what's that? That's just a rule. So I would have thought of that, you know, this kind of reaction. I would have had, you know, people actually laugh at me, you know, laugh at, you know, this kind of thing. Do you know what? It used to really annoy me at the time. It used to really, really annoy me and kind of get me down a little bit, because we hadn't got a company at this stage. We had our own company. We were sucking a load of money out of that company, putting it into RAM. It's affecting the other company. But I don't know why there was always some sort of a drive in me and Dermot to keep at this, to keep going. You know, we knew we had something. That's where, I suppose, the decision came in my mind that, you know, I just went, you know, we need to go to America. This Ireland's too small. We're too small-minded. We're too small a market anyway. You know, we've got a couple of wins, but, the, you know, Ireland's a small population. But we knew we had an international product. We knew we had something that could offer, that are in Australia, America, Europe, wherever, that there was a use for this. So that's what I literally hopped on a plane, and I had a RAM, small RAM in my backpack, and didn't know anybody or anything, just grasped on to whatever I could. And I'd done two trips. First one was to Philadelphia, Villanova University. There was an Irish guy who's a famous Irish runner who actually heads up the strength and conditioning program there, and reached out to him through email, and I said, I happen to be in Philadelphia, can I meet you? I was going to meet him. I was making it sound as if I just happened to be there. So in fairness to me, he was very accommodating. He said, yeah, no problem. I met him on the same trip. I actually drove up to Boston then after that, believe it or not. Again, it was some guy I just reached out to through IRSA. They were holding a small regional show. And then I went and I met a guy, an Irish guy who I knew used to play Gaelic sport back here, who was in America for quite a number of years and was a rep for a sales guy for Perform Better. And again, I just reached out to him. He didn't know me and whatever, so I went up there. I didn't really ever came out of any of those trips, really. I know the guys have performed better since, but nothing ever really came out of those trips. But I remember coming back from that trip and talking to Dermot after, and he's saying, what do you think? Was it worth it? And he goes, do you know what? I don't know what's going to happen, Dermot, but if we're going to make it, it's going to be in America. There's something. Like, and I go back to Ireland. We're a great country. We're a reactive market, is the way I put it. You know, we react to things out there. Whereas like when I went to America on that trip, it's such a different attitude. You know, any of those people I met, they were, and this is the way I always put it, America to me is a proactive market. So, you know, all of those people that I met really on that trip, they all said, listen, JP, I'm not the guy for you, but I know a guy who might be the guy for you, and what I'll do is I'll put you in touch. So I know America, you guys very much pride in your network, and you know it is a big thing to have your network and build it up. That's what happened. You know that came back from that, you know, with a, even though nothing really happened, but it came back with a buzz. So I took a second trip out to America, and I ended up going to a trade show called IRSA. And again, I didn't know anybody or anything. I walked up to, it was actually in San Diego, and I walked up to, I sort of knew of an Irish guy that worked for a company. I heard somewhere along the lines, and he said, yeah, he'll take me to introduce me to a couple of people. So we walked up to the Power Systems stand. Power Systems are a big distributor. And we actually introduced me straight to one of their owners and one of the main guys. And there was me trying to be, you know, all this, you know, trying to put this projection out of that I am someone, even though I wasn't anything. I showing them the RAM, and then I set the RAM down on the ground. I was there trying to be, these guys were in the suits and whatever, and trying to be all this, that, and the other. And the next thing all I heard from the background was this big Texan accent. And, well, man, what's this? Who owns this, man? What's this? a turned around, and there was this. I don't know if you remember. Yancey's naturally he's like a farmer over here who cuts the hay twice a year. He lets the hair grow and then he cuts it short. He lets the hair grow and he cuts it short. It was like this, and I turned around and seen this mad guy with this mad hair, a headband across him, and he picked up the ram. I think it was an 8 kg ram at the time, and he just started doing stuff with it in the floor, in the middle of the power systems floor. Show, he was doing squats, he was doing lunges, he was doing Russian twists, he was rolling on it, and he was giving a whole running commentary at the time when he was doing, man, this is good, this is really good, who owns this? So anyway, he got up, and I'd finished talking to the guys, and he came over to me, goes, I believe you're the guy, are you the guy that owns this, or had brought this here? And I went, yeah, that's me. He shook my hand, he says, I'm Yancey Culp, and I went, I'm JP. And he said, where is this? I've never seen this before. Where do you come from? What is this? So we gave him a little bit of the brief description of us. You know, ram, recycled tires, you know, functional movement, you know, all that. He goes, no, I get it, man, yeah. You know what? I'm involved in this sport called OCR, and I think this could be something that could be really good for it. And I remember going, OC what? And he went, OCR, obstacle course racing. And I went, oh yeah, I think I know what that is, not knowing what it was at all. And he went, do you know Spartan? Do you ever hear of the Spartan races? And somewhere in the back of my head, I went, yeah, is that the thing where you're running through fields, through mud and barbed wire and all that type of stuff? Went, yeah, exactly, that's it. I'm from that sport. A big background in that sport. I know I'm very good friends with the owner of Spartan Races, Joe DeSena, and I think this is something that could be really interesting in that sport. And that's how it happened. That's how the initial meet and greet between me and Yancey. And funny, years later, that was back in like 2018, and again, I'll fast forward a little bit to everything else that has happened in between, but me and Yancey would have a little bit of a habit of, you know, once we get, obviously I attend quite a number of the DECA events. Last night when it's all done and dusted, me and Yancey would go for a quiet drink, or, you know, a bit of food, a quiet drink. Ricardo, you've been there, you know.
Yeah.
And we'd chat about it. It's a great time. You know, we'd chat about everything and anything. Like, we have a very good relationship, myself and Yancey. The times when we were chatting, we were just reminiscing a little bit about how we met, and Yancey just said, you know what, JP, all that we've done so far, and we've loads more to do, it might never have happened, because literally 5 minutes before you landed to this power system stand that time, he's about to go to the bathroom. He was in bad need to go to the bathroom. He said, if I had left 5 minutes earlier, I would have went down the corridor to the bathroom, had a number of other people that to meet on other stands, you know, just to say hello. I probably wouldn't have been back for at least an hour and a half type thing, and we would have completely missed each other. So it's funny how life, and sometimes you're that much away from it being a bad thing, good thing, whatever, you know. It's just funny how life can. Life is such a fine edge, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say.
I like to say that a coincidence is a miracle where God remains anonymous.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that takes us right up to where the three of us met, which was in Los Angeles, 2023. DECA was putting on a strong for the IDEA World Conference. For those who aren't in the fitness industry, IDEA World is a major fitness conference. They have, you know, the biggest names in fitness there teaching lots of great sessions, how to build your business, how to become a better trainer. You know, it's attended by big and small names in fitness throughout. And so DECA's putting on a DECA Strong out where the products are marketed. So, you know, there's all these TRX and CBD and supplements and, you know, fitness wear and everything. And here we are putting on a DECA Strong event in the middle of this show. And Alton and I were there helping with that, and you were there helping as well. And we spent a couple of days together getting people through, and through all this, you know, we would talk obviously in between, and in the evenings we, you know, go to dinner and hear stories about, you know, from Yancey of meeting, you know, here he is putting a button on the pants of a country singer named Dwight Yoakam while he's wearing the pants, and selling $8,000 worth of sushi to the Beastie Boys, and all of Yancey's stories. But in the midst of all of that, I was encouraging you guys, you and Joe and Yancey, hey, you got to do a race. And of course, everybody's tired being on our feet all the day. And Yancey said, oh, I just turned myself inside out at these. I just can't. I don't have anything left. And I was telling you, and you were, you know, equivocating. And I said, look, JP, I'll do it with you. We'll do a relay. You know, and you came back to me later, and I thought I was done for the day. And you came back to me and said, hey, Ricardo, I'll do that relay. So I go upstairs and change, get into my clothes, come back, and I'm expecting to come down and just warm up. And actually, I wasn't even going to warm up. We were just doing it to do it. I was just doing it to be with you. And okay, we'll do this together. And you were in your convention clothes. You were wearing pants and a polo. And I come back from changing, and you come almost, not quite running up to me, but you come up to me, and it's clear from your body language there's something urgent. And in your Irish brogue, say, Ricardo, Yancey's going to race us. And it took me a minute to decode, what does this mean? And I realized, we're about to have a race. Oh, no. I'm not ready for this. So take it from there, JP.
I think about it every day. I'm laying in my bed, and the alarm goes off at 5:30, and I'm like, oh, man, do I want to get up today? And then I think of LA 23, and I go, yeah, I'm getting up. there were long days at that show, and you know, we were all tired, and I wasn't overly motivated to do it, but Yancey got a burst of energy from somewhere, and I could see him. And going back to my sporting days that we were chatting about earlier on, you know, you used to get, I'm sure you guys have this phrase too, you used to get start to feel flies. You know, we call it, there used to be an old coach of mine used to talk about the butterflies, you know, in your stomach. And I could see Yancey bouncing up and down. He came running past me a couple of times saying, I'm coming for you. We're coming for you. We're coming for you. And it must have been, you know, the real old competitive streak in me went, well, if he's coming, I'm going to have to give something here. And just in the finger wave, I went, this guy's going to put it up. You know, so I'm not going to, he's going to put me down. You know, this kind of, you know, you start, the competitive edge basically kicks in. And that's when I went to you, Ricardo, these guys are on for a race here. Now I will preface it that it was long days. I wouldn't like to come up again, Yancey, when he's at his pomp. In fairness, a very, very good partner that day. I'm glad you chose me, Ricardo. And it was tit for tat the whole way right through. I always remember it. It was just like, I was actually quite surprised. I remember coming off whatever it was. I can't remember exactly which one we were about. Zone 3, zone 4, and I looked across and I was there, I think we're in front here. You know, I think we're in front. And then I probably turned around, Ricardo, let's start doing this. And you talk about a change in expression in me. I could just see, and again, we have this other phrase back here at home, the thickness coming out in you, Ricardo. You were just zoned in at that stage. We went right through, it was literally zone by zone by zone, looking across at each other. We got to zone 10 onto the burpees. The Ram burpees, and again it just literally came down to one or two burpees. We were the world champions, Ricardo. That's basically what I'm saying. We were the world champions. In Kent, Hunter, the you know, all the top guys might have been over on that side competing, but we beat them all. We beat and Yancey, obviously.
You know, one of the most tightest, exciting race I've ever been a part of. There were so many lead changes, and to come down to one or two burpees at the end, and you know, here you are, we're all tired. They were not great times, you know, but we were certain
it wasn't about the time that day. It was all about pride. It was all about the pride.
It was about the pride. So, yeah, we were all exhausted. It wasn't our best athletic performance, but it was the best we had at that moment. We were not holding anything back. And here's what I love about that. You know, I mean, we went from, I'm just trying to get you to do something physical, you know, to just do, just participate. And you and I had begun to know each other over those couple of days. And we went from acquaintances or maybe people that are in each other's network, as you say. But that race, we became friends. And it's just amazing what happens when you get, when you're all in together and you're sweating together and you're giving it your everything, the bond that takes place between people when you're willing to really put yourself out there. There's something, I don't know, the guard goes down and there's just that connection between souls of, hey, we gave it our all together. And it is one of my favorite memories of racing of all time. I still think of it fondly from time to time.
Yeah, well, I do. I totally agree, and I get what you're saying, Ricardo. It's a little bit going back to when I talk about my time playing in my own sport, and you know, you put yourself out there when you're on a team. You know, when you're expecting the person that's alongside you, shoulder to shoulder, to do the same, and sometimes you might falter a little bit, but when you have that person on your shoulder, who's, you see them pushing it on, it makes you get, you'll go back at it again, because you don't want to let that person down. And those kind of moments, that's, you're right, you're dead right, that's where you build up a bond and a trust, and you see into people, you know, that you see, you know, Ricardo, you know, do you know what, I wouldn't have got through that, only Ricardo was there, you know, that day, that kind of a feel. And and we can always say, Jansi Kulp, this is regardless of whatever happens now, regardless, it doesn't matter. It's like it doesn't matter about Rocky 2, you know, Apollo 3, or whatever. You know, it's always about the first one. It's always about the first one.
Oh, you got it.
All right, JP. Well, this has been wonderful. A lot of great stories and insights for our listeners. So if people are interested in learning more about you and what you're doing, what's the best way for them to do that? The
best way is really learn a little bit about us and what we do through our own website, ramfit.com. And you can reach out to me direct, jpmohn@ramfit.com. That's my direct email. Or the company email, which generally comes back to me anyway, which is info@ramfit.com. And I always say, we're never out to try and revolutionize the world of fitness here at Ramfit. You know what we do, we pride ourselves in the simplicity of our products, but what we have is products that can really help people, you know, and maybe that's the beauty of what we have is the simplicity. You know, they're extremely durable, and also incredibly versatile as well. So yeah, and I love telling people about what we do. I do believe that we can provide a lot of value to businesses out there. You know, we deal, you know, the beauty of what we do as well is I get the opportunity to talk directly to businesses, to gyms, directly to boot camps, you know, with what I do. So we're not like the big guys where it's just an email. You know, generally you're going to talk to me direct at some stage, and then, you know, being involved with things like DECA, it allows me to go to certain places, certain venues, where I get to meet these people who are behind phone calls or emails. I get to meet these people in person. So again, we like to think we're only a small company, but because we're a small company, there's a big benefit to that as well, that that there's a person behind that voice, or a person behind that phone call, or a person behind that email who's willing to listen to your needs, what you need, and hopefully, you know, we can help you solve whatever issues you may have.
Excellent. Well, thank you for your time. I know it's definitely going to be a great episode for our listeners. If you're interested in doing some DECA personalized training with us or resilience coaching with Coach Ricardo, there will be links in the description of the video that you're watching for this, or if you're listening on podcast form, the links will be in the description for that. Or if you're interested in reaching out to me personally on Instagram, I'm AltonMullinX17_, or on Facebook at Coach Alton. If people are interested in reaching out to you, Coach, what's the best way to do that?
I love talking to people about resilience, whether that's one-on-one resilience coaching or coming to your team or business and talking about resilience. So you can get a hold of me at coach.ricardo on Instagram or Ricardo Mullinex on Facebook. JP, it has been a wonderful time together. I'm looking forward to us spending time together at DECA World Championships in Florida. And hopefully we're going to get done with the setup and the changeover before the middle of the night this year and get a chance to get back out and grab some food together and catch up. Thank you for sharing your stories of resilience. I know it's going to make a difference in our listeners' lives.
You guys, and can I just say, listen, what you guys are doing with the podcast, it's absolutely fantastic. You know, what you're basing it around, resilience in life. You know, I just think it's so important, especially in today's world, you know, that whatever it is, whatever way we're living today's world, we seem to be putting a lot of different pressure ourselves. Young people seem to be, you know, maybe not being able to cope as well. Necessarily be young people, could be older people. But the more you talk about what the subject matter that you guys want to bring to the fore, the better it is, you know, and being able to give people the tools on how to deal with that is just so important, because at the end of the day, it happens in life. You know, it's going to happen. You know, that's one sure thing about life. It's going to happen. If you're lucky enough to have listened to a podcast like yourself, at least you're going to be hopefully a little bit more prepared for when that time comes. So well done, guys.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Well, thank you guys for tuning in to this week's episode of Ricardo's Rules of Resilience, the podcast where we give you the tools to withstand and overcome difficulties. Be resilient.
Season 2 of Ricardo's Rules of Resilience podcast is brought to you by RamFit. Here at RamFit, we take material destined for landfill and turn it into high-performance training gear that lasts, because we believe we can have fitter people and a fitter planet. In the dynamic world of fitness equipment, our indestructible training tools, made from recycled materials, promises to revolutionize your workouts and deliver unmatched durability. By embracing the RamFit philosophy, you're not only enhancing your workouts, but also contributing to a more sustainable future. RamFit. Fitter people, fitter planet.